Space Oddity.
Hello and welcome to the new episode of Space Oddity. I'm Christopher and today's introductory host. In this episode, we're going to follow the discussion by our three podcast guests, visiting scholar Jamie Hakim, associate Anna Steigemann, and project researcher Sungun Gang. Today, they're talking about the CARE Manifesto and collective interdisciplinary working experience, questioning if a CARE movement worldwide is needed and what is actually permissive CARE. Furthermore, they touch the topic of the rise of awareness teams in queer spaces, and as well as they are discussing the issue of positioning yourself, your research and activist position. But before we join the discussion, I'll briefly introduce today's speaker. Our first guest is Jamie Hakim. Jamie has been a guest researcher at the CSC 1265 in Berlin from May until end of June. He is a lecturer in culture, media and creative industries at King's College London and earned his PhD in 2012 at the University of East London. He was a principal investigator on the ESRC-funded project Digital Intimacies, and his latest book was published in 2019 by Roman and Littlefield with the title Works at Body, May Bodies in Digital Culture. He's also part of the CARE Collective and co-authored the CARE Manifesto, The Politics of Interdependence in 2020, and his research interests are queer masculinities, digital cultures, intimacy, embodiment, and care. Our second guest is Anna Steigemann, and Anna is an associate member at the CSC 1265 and also a senior researcher at the Habitat Technical University of Berlin. She holds a professorship in sociological dimensions of space at the Center for International and Transnational Area Studies, shortly CITES, at the University of Regensburg. She earned her PhD in sociology at the TU Berlin in 2017, and her key research focuses are on critical urban studies, migration and the city, community and neighborhood studies, governments from below, postcolonial urban theories, as well as on ethnographic and qualitative social research methods. Our third guest for today is Sungun Gang, and Sungun Gang is a postdoc researcher here at the CRC 1265 and is a member of the project BO3, Smart People, Queer Everyday Lives in Digitalized Spaces. Sungun earned his PhD last year in Theater and Media Studies at the University of Cologne, and his academic background is German studies. His research interests are cultural history of Korea, queer studies, urban culture, postcolonial studies, and discourse analysis. Sungun is also a podcast producer of the Queer Asian Interview podcast Bin ich süß sauer? Am I sweet sour? So, enjoy today's episode.
So, hello everyone. My name is Jamie Hakim and I'm a lecturer in culture, media and creative industries at King's College in London.
Hello everybody, my name is Anna Steigemann. I have to apologize for my voice, it's gone since a couple of months. I'm a professor for the sociological dimensions of space. That means I'm a mix of an urban and spatial researcher, mostly in sociology, but also in the other urban studies disciplines at University of Regensburg, with my research projects partly still being at TU Berlin.
Hi, my name is Sungun Gang. I'm a postdoc researcher at this collective research center at TU Berlin. And my project is about queer people's everyday lives in Seoul, South Korea, where I'm from as well. So you're having Jamie today, and it's a great pleasure to have you here and to finally gather together, because I've known your work through the CRC, right?
Yeah.
Your research focus is also on queer life in urban spaces,
yeah.
Right? And Jamie, I already talked to you last week because we had a lunch together, and I also talked to you that one of your works, the CARE Manifesto, mm-hmm. was translated into Korean language.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And it found some resonance in Korean society.
Great. So congrats.
I know. I knew about the translation, but the publisher hasn't forwarded us any of the kind of reviews or anything, so it was very exciting to hear.
Yeah, there are lots of discussions going on, actually, because there are lots of political decisions to make, and people are trying to bring these aspects into this discussion, but it's a hard fight, I would say. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah. How about we start just talking about CARE Manifesto, if it is okay with you?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So I was just really curious about the start, because usually as researchers, right, or me being from a researcher from humanities, I'm not really experienced in working in collective
mm-hmm.
with other people from many different fields. So how did you start it, even the Care Collective?
So the Care Collective initially was a reading group, which I joined kind of a little bit later than the original kind of, well, there were six or seven people, and then eventually it was the four. And so they wanted to, well, start reading about questions of care because it had become such a massive problem. I mean, in the UK, but also it seems globally, if, you know, the kinds of ways that caring infrastructures had been completely kind of diminished under neoliberalism for, you know, certainly since austerity in the UK, but certainly before that too. And I met Andreas Hatzidakis out socially, and we got talking, and he invited me to join. I have typically worked on questions of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
So there was overlap. I mean, the way that we ended up framing care in the manifesto was kind of much broader than the kind of interpersonal. But there was overlap between kind of my research interests and what they were discussing. And yeah, I joined that reading group. And so that reading group consists of Lynn Siegel, who's quite a renowned kind of socialist feminist that was very involved in the second wave in the UK. Jo Lifler also has a background like me in cultural studies. Catherine Rottenberg, who some listeners might know because she had written a book on neoliberal feminism that was very well received. I mean, her background's kind of American studies, but, you know, she also has a kind of literature, feminist theory background. And Andreas Hatzidakis, who has a kind of critical marketing background. I've talked just about the academic credentials. I mean, they were also activists in different ways. And certainly Lynn has been involved in activist struggles for, you know, the last 40 years. And the point, once we began to realise, you know, reading important texts on care, Joan Tronto, looking at films, so I was bringing kind of queer politics to the table, and we looked at some kind of care politics around the HIV crisis, a manifesto was the kind of way to go, basically. I mean, in terms of interdisciplinary backgrounds, technically we are interdisciplinary, but I mean, we definitely share very similar kind of political and epistemological kinds of perspectives. And you're right, I think in humanities, which most of us are from, it is rare. Social sciences tends to work in big teams. And it was just important for us to work kind of collectively. And it was a political thing, you know, that we need to think about these questions kind of collectively. But also, I mean, you know, sometimes collectives kind of fall apart. Well, we actually got on very well. There was a couple of kind of disagreements in the writing of the manifesto, but mostly I would say that working as a collective has proven enormously kind of useful in terms of the thinking we ended up doing around the manifesto.
Mm-hmm.
And was there any decisive moment as you all agreed on, okay, let's write the manifesto and let's start the revolution?
I could be wrong here, and my colleagues in the collective might remember it differently. My memory was that it was Lynn that had decided that we write a manifesto, which made sense given what her kind of background and experience was. So yeah, there was a period where we were just reading or watching films or reading poems or kind of a whole range of different cultural production that looked at care. And it just became obvious there was a massive care problem, not only in the more traditional kind of caring industry, you know, so like care work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the situation in the UK is terrible. I mean, it has been so kind of neoliberalized and emptied out. The care workers, massively underpaid, extremely difficult working conditions. I mean, the best example I can give of that is the kind of disaster that happened in the care homes during the pandemic. So many people died in the care homes because the caring infrastructures were so poorly equipped at being able to deal with. But then we began to think about it in a more kind of abstract sense and realize that, you know, it's not just care work and questions of mothering and social reproduction. But one of the things that neoliberalism has done is try to make us only understand each other as individuals in competition with each other. And what happens to care? There's no space in that kind of rubric for caring. And hence the need for the manifesto, basically. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see some parallels between UK or in South Korea and also Germany, what's going on, right? Even,
yes.
Yeah, during the pandemic, but after pandemic, well, it comes to me sometimes like we all forgot what we had to learn during the pandemic. We are clapping hands to people who are working in this field, and we are talking about raising their working conditions and everything, all right? But do you also sometimes witness such moments that this kind of manifesto or this kind of movement is still needed also in Germany, Anna?
Absolutely. What I find interesting, and that is also more linked to my research, is the more informalized care. Like whenever communities step in when the state is not providing care, or the health system or whatever, you know, like care system, official care system, which is definitely underpaid and super precarious and on the shoulders of particularly precariously paid women, I find it interesting of how then informally individuals or collectives or certain structures evolve of how communities care about the community members themselves as kind of a lesson from a neoliberal system, but also in a system that capitalizes on knowing that the communities will help themselves, which I find very dangerous, politically different. But it's interesting to see what kind of urban infrastructure it was around that. And this is actually where my research starts, kind of, as basically coming from classical neighborhood and community studies, the queer community being just one of the many communities I look at, seeing how with the closing of the queer bars, the clubs, but also centers like the Schulenberatung, the Sneakers, how very important and formalized care and knowledge structures completely fell apart and left particularly a lot of young queers, the newcomers to the city, totally on their own in a very isolated and dangerous situation. Mm-hmm. That's where I see a lot of connections to James' work and yours as well.
I completely agree. I mean, in the UK, I'm sure as well, I presume in Korea and Germany, we had mutual aid groups that were not queer, that were just set up in communities that, you know, did the work that wasn't possible in the conditions of the pandemic, but also was not possible because of so many years of austerity, basically. But, you know, the queer stuff is very interesting, and have been the kind of research I've started doing in Berlin has shown me the stuff that you're talking about. So I was speaking to somebody from Lecken yesterday, and they talked about having care pods and people taking care of each other, and this very specific issues that queer people face when they've moved away from family and are young and can be precariously employed. And so there's overlap for sure in the stuff I'm doing at the moment.
Maybe you can talk about it later more in detail.
Sure.
About your research and then queer spaces, which is also a burning interest of mine.
Sure.
To bring back our attention to the queer collective again and queer manifesto.
Sure.
I'm just halfway through, to be honest, reading the Care Manifesto in Korean language.
Yeah.
And I sent you the question before I read the book, and I was aware of the term promiscuous care because it was also a lot discussed term in Korean public, right?
Sure.
Because it's a catchy word, because it has an obvious sexual connotation.
Sure.
Right. So some people were just confused from listening to what? Promiscuous and care. How can these two words combine together? What they mean? And plus, there are lots of care workers in Korea who are women, and they do experience some violence based on their sexuality in their caring work. So I think this term was also partially because of that reason was, I would say, enjoyed with care in Korean discussion. Could you explain why did you come up with this term and how can you understand this?
Sure.
Anna?
Sorry, I have a question. What do you mean with sexualized violence by providing care?
Yeah.
And can you give me examples?
Yeah, for instance, there are lots of women who are taking care of elders, and often it takes place in their private spaces, right? And then when they're there and when they're taking care of these elders, mostly male gendered elder, who is over, 70, 80, and who is dependent on this woman, they harass the woman, for instance.
Okay.
And there are lots of cases like that.
Yeah, too. Germany too.
Mm. Yeah, and in the UK, sure. Yeah. I'm glad you asked me about this. This is my contribution to the manifesto because it comes from research that I was doing around the HIV activism. So in exactly the same context as what Anna had just talked about, the way that the queer community had to gather themselves and kind of begin to set up kind of informal, kind of grassroots care structures during the early days of the HIV epidemic, particularly I was looking at the States. So organizations like ACT UP, basically, and then initiatives in San Francisco. And the term promiscuous care comes from an article by Douglas Crimp, who is an academic, but also an activist that was involved in ACT UP, from an article called How to Have Promiscuity in an Epidemic. And It's a fascinating article, and what he's doing is he's trying to kind of argue against some of what you might call the kind of erotophobic response to queer sexual cultures during the pandemic, because a lot of the arguments that, you know, certainly a lot of right-wing and conservative press were saying, but also gay leaders, is that gay people should just stop having sex because that will stop the spread of the pandemic. I mean, that's just not possible.
And the same during the COVID pandemic.
Exactly. I mean, the parallels are very kind of interesting. Yeah. And so he argues, he makes the case for, it's a really interesting case, that the queer promiscuity that was happening, particularly amongst gay men in New York in the 70s and 80s, he argues provided the condition for developing safer sex techniques. Mm. Because if you look at the kind of sexual cultures of New York at that time, they were experimenting. He uses the expression, I'm paraphrasing, it was multiplying and experimenting with sexual practices beyond the penetrative sex, which was the major route of HIV transmission. And it was within those cultures, the leather cultures, the kink cultures, the kind of counterpublic kind of sexual spaces, that they developed a massive array of kind of complex sexual practices, which meant you could have sex, but you weren't necessarily going to have penetrative sex, which was one of the major routes, I'm repeating myself, that of course HIV. That has an argument, I read that as an undergraduate, and it has just stayed with me forever. And it got me thinking in conversations with the Care Collective, you know, how might that argument be applied in the context of care? And specifically, what I've taken from the term promiscuous isn't that you have sex with as many people as possible, which is the kind of common sense kind of argument. Often there's a moral connotation to that term as well. It's his definition as multiplication and experimentation with different sorts of practices. So it's that. And so what in that particular chapter on caring kinships, I led authored on that, but we all kind of obviously worked on that together. So we basically say that the kind of dominant forms of caring that exist at the moment, as we've just been discussing, are completely inadequate in terms of, you know, dealing with people's caring needs. And so that's not just under neoliberalism, but that's kind of much longer, which is kind of based on a household where a woman does all the social reproduction and isn't paid for it. I mean, it's terrible for women. It's terrible for the people they're caring for in many different ways. And so what that particular chapter is like a provocation to begin to think about the multiple ways that you might experiment with new forms of caring practice outside of that very kind of narrowly defined kind of caring model, which continues to prevail kind of today. So that was where the kind of idea for promiscuous care came from. I mean, the decision to use the term promiscuous care was deliberately provocative. And that provocation was meant to be generative in terms of trying to get people to think about it. Interestingly, there were two or three kind of points of contention within the discussions when we were writing that. And the use of the term promiscuous was one of them because of potentially, you know, that reception of it. And I guess that's a shame, but hopefully when people read the chapter, they'll see that, I mean, I don't have a problem with promiscuous sexual practice in the more common sense term, but it isn't really about that. It's about proliferating who and how we care for and the practices, you know, that we use. And hopefully people can read that and take that away from it.
Thank you. And now listening to you, I can understand it better. And also, it's about experimenting and finding ways, but also the background was at the time of seemingly impossible era where you can't have sex at all, right? So I think it is also really important to understand the background of the term. Anna, can you provide us with examples in German context?
That is brilliant, Jamie, because it's also a metaphor, multiplying care beyond a very nuclear family orientation, heteronormativity, and kind of an enabler, facilitator for connectivity also, like care that is on multiple shoulders and where everybody has a sensitivity for it and where everybody is doing it, eventually also has incorporated into everyday routines and taken away from a classical care structure provided by the state or whatever private companies. And yeah, I think that also gives some hope of taking the pressure from some kind of exploited individuals away and makes it a collective practice in the end, that is also then a little bit more, stable and resilient towards all the multiple crises that we will probably face in the next years.
And when we speak about queer spaces and queer nightlife, mm-hmm. I think we should also talk about awareness teams, because it seems to be one of those practices that could be understood as a sort of promiscuous care, I think.
And if, and like in the interviews I did so far, in the conversations I had with many of the different members of the people who provide awareness in clubs, but also at other events or institutions, actually the goal of them is that they make themselves obsolete at a certain point. By being present in these spaces, people learn to also take care about each other, developing a certain kind of awareness that eventually we don't need awareness teams.
Interesting.
Anymore.
That's so interesting.
Which is also very anti-capitalist, because in the end so far, they also partly make money with it.
Sure.
But their aim is to actually make themselves obsolete when the community can take care of each other in a way that we don't need anyone to care about overdoses or sexual harassment in these spaces because they don't necessarily happen anymore.
I also went through the book and I learned that the Care Manifesto was co-authored by, I guess, 5 people.
Yeah.
And I was just curious about the writing experience, because usually we are writing the text by yourselves, so alone, or top 1 or 2 other people, but with 5 people as a team on texts, printing a text, how was it?
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, I've co-authored a few times, but never with 5 people. It worked out quite well, mostly, because basically, the way that we've organized the book is around these 5 different scales. So we've used, and actually I think this comes from geography and urban studies, which isn't my background, but thinking at different scales, basically. And so going from the interpersonal to communities, to the state, to economies, to the world. And so each of us was responsible, I think that maps onto 5 different, onto each one of those kinds of, each one of those scales, basically. And at the beginning, there's a diagnostic part of the manifesto, which diagnoses the problems at these scales where kind of care has been insufficiently organized. And then there's the kind of manifesto where we propose different kind of solutions to these problems. And so in that respect, it worked out quite well, because in the 5 of us, there was 5 scales. There were also disagreements. Promiscuous care was one of them. Mm-hmm. I think another one of them was whether we would use the term caring markets or caring economies. And that showed up some political differences around relationships to capitalism, which was interesting, but also difficult at times. But fundamentally, they were kind of, you know, they were resolved. And, we get on with each other and we care about each other. And one thing that's important to say is that, you know, caring isn't always easy. It comes with difficulties. You know, one of the things we say in the manifesto is that one of the reasons that the world is not as caring as it should be is because care itself is a very difficult form of labor that kind of, without going too much into the theory of it, which reminds you of your own mortality. If you are trying to keep something alive and well, you can be reminded that you might also not be alive. So people with a more psychoanalytic background in the group were kind of very cognizant of the kind of negativity that can come with kind of caring. And so, yeah, that came out a bit, but we resolved it. I wish I could remember how now we wrote it a few years ago. But I mean, ultimately, it was a good experience. And I think there is definitely something to, and we learned from each other from our different perspectives. And I think if you can manage the differences and the this is a problem for any collective. I think if you manage the difficulties and the problems, then it can be enormously kind of rewarding and supportive to work in a collective way.
And super inspiring.
Yeah. We were intergenerational as well. You know, Lynn just turned 80. You know, her experience on these questions, you know, from the 70s was just fascinating, and we kind of cascade downwards. There was an intergenerational component to it as well. And yeah, it was very inspiring, you're right.
And can I ask you two, just one general question? Since I started at this research project and I'm getting in touch with lots of sociologists and urban studies scholars, and they're quite different from people who I'm met in media studies department, for instance, or literature studies department. And one of the most striking difference for me is that lots of them are at the same time as activists, very active, or they are in touch with activists, especially in a city like Berlin. And also your work, the Care Manifesto, it's a very inspiring text, but also it could ignite an activism. And so do you, and also Anna, you are also focusing on lots of urban activisms or people doing many different things. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with the call for, I'd say, quote unquote, staying objective as scholar? because this topic I get again and again. So mm-hmm. people say to me, oh, well, yeah, in activist scene, maybe it's possible, but we are now talking about academia.
Mm-hmm.
So using this term, for instance, like safe space, we yeah. should be really careful.
I have to say, I don't think there is such a thing as objectivity in the social sciences.
Mm.
Because depending on our positionality, who we ask other questions or certain questions.
Mm.
Because I'm a woman,
mm.
I make sense of the world in a completely different way. Because of my class background, because of my sexual orientation, because of how I grew up, I see certain things and I ask certain questions. I think the objectivity, what makes it scientific, is the rigidity and validity of my methods and the systematic the way I approach my topic. I don't believe, I mean, it makes a difference if I do research or Jamie would work on the same topic. We would come to certain, completely different findings eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So I reject that notion of objectivity, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I would answer in exactly the same way. And yeah, it's also the degree to which you're able to reflect, to be self-reflexive about your positionality and the place you have in the construction of knowledge that, you know, you're involved in. Was the only thing that I would add. I completely agree.
Mm.
Knowledge production is entirely... I'm also completely convinced by feminist standpoint theory that there is no such thing as an all-seeing, a possibility of an all-seeing kind of objective position where you can take it in the round. You know, you inhabit the world that you're researching from a very particular position, and you just need to account for that position and how it shaped the knowledge that you've produced, basically.
Mm.
In terms of activism, so my background's kind of cultural studies, and the two go hand in hand. And partly, you know, that is the kind of theoretical standpoint that's used to justify it, but it's an understanding that culture plays an important part in the kind of in political struggle and in political practices. And it's not possible to look at kind of cultural production, whether that's textual or whether that's subcultural and people, without understanding the kinds of political stakes that are involved in them, basically. So that notion of an objective social science is, I similarly mm. reject it.
Mm-hmm.
And I work a lot with action research and participatory action research, and my underlying agenda is always, if I collaborate with so many members of very vulnerable or marginalized communities, that the knowledge we co-produce is also actually helping them to fight for the cause or for the existence in the end. So I have this political notion of, yes, this is not merely basic Grundlagenforschung knowledge that stays within academia, is used for my own CV, my own projects, but also that there is some outtakes and there is some knowledge that also helps them.
Mm.
And I think that's a very common approach in urban studies, more than in sociology, I would say,
mm-hmm.
because it's very applied knowledge that in the end is also should partly also make our cities more livable cities.
Mm.
I'm very open about that. I mean, if you're a queer person, your existence is political. You are an activist by fighting for your existence, mm. more or less, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and so then, you know, from what the previous discussions we've had about your research on
mm-hmm.
its queer spaces in Korea, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that could not be political. I don't see how. I mean, there's a reason that you're looking into that because, you know, I presume, so I'm speaking for you, but that project sounds like it's interested in, yeah, how queer people make their lives livable in the spaces available to them at a particular moment in time. And that's a deeply political question, it seems to me. It's one that can't just be understood objectively, particularly if you're a queer person that's had a certain type of experience
mm.
in that space, in those spaces.
Yeah, and we are seeing that live now because queer people in Korea, they applied for using the place right in front of the city hall of city center, Seoul, this year again, since 2015. So it was kind of an established, I would say almost institution that somewhere in June or July, the queer cultures festival takes place at this very symbolic place. But this year, the city government just rejected it. So we are literally looking for space to take place the queer festival. So I'm trying to somehow remain at distance, weirdly enough. But otherwise, I can imagine that I'll just jump right in and just be full on the way with the movement. But at the same time, I'm just thinking, well, as you said, Anna, just being there, just talking about this topic itself is regarded political, yeah. Right?
Since particularly the official spaces that were claimed or institutionalized or given for, provided for, I mean, almost all cities have a LGBT kind of office and anti-discrimination office, and yes, there is some state support for many of the queer institutions. But aside from that, many of these spaces are in very precarious situations, and with gentrification, they are even more displaced or endangered. However, I think this is where a lot of informal claiming space practices become very important.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about Pansy's Drag Race in Hasenheide, for instance, it's just claiming the space for a couple of hours, clearing the space for a couple of hours. I mean, Hasenheide is a kind of queer space in general,
mm-hmm.
depending on who you ask and what place in Hasenheide you look at. But there's a lot of, you know, like other ways of claiming space outside of hoping that the state will allow to give you that kind of space. And I think this is a practice that's very common and has a long history in queer history in general. Because if we wait until the space is given to us, then we can wait forever.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I agree. And during your stay in Berlin, you're also doing research, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell us stories from your research in Berlin so far?
Yeah. So, I mean, the reason I've come to Berlin is because I'm just finishing a project on intimacy. And one of the things that we've become interested in that project is what we're calling collective spaces of intimacy. And that we're using broadly to describe not just the obvious place where people may have sex or might have intimacy, but where queer communities begin to kind of form kind of relationalities in and of themselves. And that became a massive issue, as me and Anna have discussed before, in relation to the pandemic when they were shut, and that had very particular consequences. So I don't typically work with space, actually. The thing that I've become interested in, and the next project which I want to start, is what I'm calling at the moment the cultural politics of queer collectivity. And so looking at the rise of queer, it's a lot of them are young queer kind of people who have organized themselves in collectives, into collectives, call themselves collectives in different areas of cultural life. At the moment, I'm focusing on nightlife. And as this notorious globally, you know, Berlin is a nightlife center. It's a queer nightlife center. And what's clear to me, even before coming here and like having serious kind of conversations in the field, is that it has a kind of activist kind of orientation. And I think a lot of the kind of features of contemporary nightlife, which I'm beginning to see in London, it seems fair to say they've originated in Berlin.
Mm.
So at the moment, what I'm doing is trying to speak to people who are involved in these queer collectives, and they didn't want to be anonymous. So I can say I've spoken to people at Buttons, and I'm going to speak to people at Lekken, and I'm going to speak to people at Room for Resistance. I've spoken to someone at TS Raver. So these are various kind of collectives involved in the particular type of queer nightlife scene here.
Mm.
And I'm just, this is something Anna, I think, has researched and is involved in, and I'm just finding my feet there. But I mean, it's fascinating to me, you know, in London, London is a very established and commercial city. You know, it was a center of neoliberalism as a political project, but also in terms of homonormative forms of nightlife and leisure space, where it was about, you know, glamour and exclusivity and, you know, making money. And certainly in the early years of the 21st century, you know, there were private members clubs. This was a new, they've disappeared, but what a new thing that can really characterize a bit, the height of kind of, you know, neoliberalism in London was, I think there were about 3 private members clubs, which was understood to be aspirational things that people should want to go to. So this kind of more activist, leftist, that have different sorts of histories in kind of activist organizations and squat parties that, I mean, it's so precarious to say that it's established in Berlin, but there's a history of it in Berlin, right? And so, yeah, I've just started speaking to them about their practice, how they understand themselves, the origins of these awareness teams, these collectives that walk around raves, making sure people feel comfortable, they're not having bad drug experiences, protecting as much as they can against sexual harassment and sexual violence. This is a pretty unique initiative. I've heard about rave intention circles. That isn't the same as going to a private members club at all. Do you know, the contrast to me is so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
The way that it's radiating out of Berlin into spaces like London to a smaller extent represents a real kind of break in the narrative that we've, certainly in cultural studies, been telling ourselves about the success of queer life, by which we mean certain types of white gay men,
mm-hmm.
consumer cultures, gay marriage, entering the army, things like this. It's just a different narrative. And I'm here to try and understand its origins and its operations and its politics and ethics, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. It's quite unique. My research is very much linked to Jamie's research, but looking more on the spatial dimension, so the spatial politics around and the spatial production of what kind of spaces, symbolically, socially, and in terms of design, are these collectives producing?
Mm-hmm.
And how are they reusing and reappropriating existing nightlife spaces and community spaces alike? But what I find very interesting, you touched upon this issue, is, for instance, my university in Bavaria, which is a very Catholic, very remote, mid-sized town, has a university facility at the end of the semester, like a big campus fest. And they have an awareness team.
Oh.
I looked randomly, it's not a systematic research, but I looked at other spaces, like nightlife spaces in other German cities. And gradually, they're all setting up awareness teams as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, there's a need for it, obviously, but also the collectives here in Berlin do on one hand such great work, but also promote that work in very nicely networked ways, also through other queer institutions,
mm-hmm.
that there's outputs now in other cities as well.
I've spoken to people that are involved in these awareness teams initiatives, and it just seems there is so much potential to kind of scale up this sort of practice that's been developed by queer communities to look after each other in all sorts of space. I spoke to someone involved in Lekken yesterday, and they also explained, and maybe it's the same university, but it's, I mean, that there was a university conference happening in a couple of weeks, maybe, around gender studies, and there's going to be an awareness team there.
Yeah, that's
it's the same.
No, it's
different. Yeah, exactly. So this is a concept that can be kind of adapted and that has been invented. Well, not invented, has been kind of, you know, formed at this moment in a very particular way. It just shows the ingenuity of queer community kind of making and care practices. And
it's still a community practice, because I know here there's also efforts from student initiatives to have at bigger events always an awareness team on the site. But it's a bottom-up practice. It's not that the knowledge around the awareness teams and mm-hmm. awareness in general is still not in the management areas of
mm-hmm.
institutions like universities or common companies, I think. I mean, Siemens and BMW should probably also have an awareness team,
sure.
or any kind of organization, because we live in a mm-hmm. system that is full of homophobia, sexism, racism, and a lot of violence in many ways. But it's a bottom-up practice. It's also discussions around having awareness teams and alternative forms of offices and collectives you could turn to when you experience something bad is coming from the student body, not from mm-hmm. the faculty body.
Mm-hmm. I've lived for a long time in Cologne, and there is also vibrant, well, at least gay and lesbian scene. But as a person of color who's gay, I didn't really enjoy the experiences going to gay bars, because as you said, it was meant to be a very free space where everybody could have fun. But what I saw the most was white gay men who were dressed in a very similar way, sporting certain, brands,
sure.
clothes. And to borrow your language, they didn't really care about me, right? In both ways, right? So I was just there, standing there. I can just imagine, I can just see myself being there and just watching them. They watched me once, and then all the glances were just out. And I don't know, there were lots of unpleasant mm-hmm. things. But what I was talking about was, I also organized some events right before the pandemic. They all fell out, so it's a pity, but still. What is really interesting about Berlin is that there are so much going on, activists and performers, artists. And as I was planning on something similar or some events about alternative and left queer events in Cologne, we didn't have the people. So we had to invite people from Berlin. Mm-hmm. And then they asked me about, yeah, what about awareness team and what about that and that. So I think that was also interesting experience for me, that to bring these issues to people from Cologne, say, oh, well, they asked me about having awareness team. Do you have that? So I think it's also another way of spreading this idea and practice of awareness team, at least.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, in London, one of the more glamorous, in inverted commas, and exclusive looking nights called Feel It is run by a drag queen called Jodie Harsh, who I think has spent about 20 years trying to cultivate herself as a celebrity to some degree of success. The history that she has in London is to create these kind of glamorous exclusive spaces. And she started to use an awareness team. And so again, it comes, you know, I don't think Jodie would say that, well, I don't know what she would describe herself as now. Her history hasn't been one which necessarily screams activism or operating in kind of these leftist activist spaces. But you can even in London begin to see these practices move into more traditional kind of gay spaces.
On the other hand, the queer community is not free from normativities and commodification and individuals trying to capitalize on. Yeah.
And it'll be interesting. I'd like to do some kind of ethnography in that sort of space and to find out, you know. But the fact they feel they have to do it anyway shows.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I welcome that. It becomes a norm that you can't do any event or like nightlife event, but also workshop or cultural event without an awareness team anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It would be an issue. It would be an issue. It would be claimed to have an awareness team.
Mm-hmm.
And there should be, because in the end, it might or does actually make these spaces and events safer to a certain extent. It doesn't solve the issues totally, but it helps to make, particularly within the community, the most vulnerable community members more safe.
Yeah, I mean, I need to say that. So I'm doing a talk on Friday about these issues, and the kind of question that I'm posing is, you know, why have these issues emerged now? Why has the understanding of nightlife space as safe space become such a prominent one? Why have these practices of welfare teams or awareness teams become kind of common practice now? Why are there safer space discourses and policies? Because historically, when it comes to nightlife, and I think I'm mostly probably talking about nightlife that has focused gay men, cis gay men, the terms used to understand what that experience is have tended to kind of, I mean, there are kind of notions of safety and protection in there, but largely they're to do with kind of questions of transcendence, transformation and liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Not that these new initiatives have completely done away with that language. It's interesting to me that, you know, the particular approach I take from a particular tradition in cultural studies is, why has this cultural formation appeared in the way that it has now?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we understanding nightlife in terms of safety and vulnerability and violence when we didn't before? I'm not saying it was right that we didn't before. I'm not saying it's right that we are doing it now. It's a question of why.
Mm.
And so, yeah, that's the sort of thing that I'm going to get into in the talk, because it's fascinating. And I mean, I'd be interested to hear if you could, I mean, do you have any kind of critiques of it, because as a practice, because not every practice is always good. I mean, maybe they haven't kind of made themselves manifest at the moment, but
I mean, in the middle of doing the field work,
sure,
and doing the conversations and interviews with them, so I can't necessarily like,
sure,
underpin my assumptions or my preliminary findings. But so far, I'm impressed by the high degree of reflection and the lack of dogma or morality, so to say. And it's incredible. The question is, I see a bit of a gap between the publications they put out there, the wording, and the practice. Like, the practices I observe doing ethnographic work in these spaces. But I mean, of course, it's always easier to talk about what we do as a collective in doing awareness, for instance, and then really put it into practice. And I mean, they're also in quite precarious situations. Clubs in particular are very messy spaces where you don't have an overview to all the, you know, like, corners and shady spaces, because that's how clubs should be, you know. There's different layers of visibility, there's different layers of where you can hide yourself, particularly if you want to have sex. So that puts a challenge and pressure on people who do awareness, because they are usually a group of, let's say, five people for a club that is filled with hundreds of people. So you might miss a certain situation, or you might, if you have a situation, it might be hard to find them. You know, these kind of things. And also then, they're well-trained members. However, everybody of the teams does it in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a beautiful thing, but it also, yeah, produces certain social and spatial situations where I can't say it makes necessarily the space and as a total thing safer.
Mm-hmm.
Also again, what is safe is very
right.
subjective. It depends on your positionality. I think none of them claims to make the space safe. They all say they make the space eventually safer.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of my research is also asking users of these spaces of what is saferness for them.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean? What do they need in terms of also the design? Dark rooms are a big, big topic. You can design a space very well according to the needs of a very diverse community. However, it's more the spatial politics and forms of dominance that in the end make any space, how beautiful it might be designed or how appropriate it might be designed, make it spatial.
Mm.
And the spatial politics mean questions around, yeah, masculinity, dominance, consent, these kind of things, substance consumption, what is good for one person might not make feel the other person comfortable. But also when you go into, like, not talking only about nightlife spaces, but also if you go into the more conventional established institutions, they also have some sometimes very ambiguous spatial politics in terms of the services they provide. There's no mainstreaming, which is good. I think the employees still have their own styles, their own experiences, their own training, their own positionalities, but there is no one-fits-all way of providing, you know, safety in the end, you know.
In the Intimacies project, which we're just writing up, there was a fantastic, very long quote that we've ended up using in the book from someone who is transmasc and identifies as ethnically mixed, and talked about using a play space in a kind of Berlin-inspired club called Crossbreed, which it's ended, there was some drama, which I can't really get into now, but they did open up a kind of a darkroom or a play space for their punters. There was an awareness team, there was, you know, ensuring that it was mixed in a way that, you know, historically a darkroom really comes from gay male culture and is dominated kind of by gay men. And, it only has gay men in it. And, you know, the quote is very long, and the kind of journey that you go on with this person as they describe the kind of ups and downs of that space. You know, first of all, it's important to say that if someone who wasn't a cis kind of gay man wanted to have that sort of sexual experience, they just couldn't. I mean, there are very few places. So another feature of this generation of clubs, which I'm interested in, is precisely the creation. And there are many things, you know, the awareness teams is one, but the creation of a darkroom for people who aren't cis gay men is an innovation. And so that itself was interesting. But, you know, they had gone in with somebody that they knew. The person in the sexual encounter used slightly misgendering language, which completely threw them. Then, you know, there was a whole kind of range of different things that happened to them. And I'd also say in that particular context, you know, there's only so much that a safer team can do. When it comes to questions of sex and intimacy, there's a particular kind of theoretical tradition that understands, you know, in queer theory, that understands that sex and intimacy can undo you because,
absolutely,
A, it's very intense. It can be very intense. And B, it's completely dependent on another person, which you are not fully in control of. You know, it's an interesting job to kind of manage that space, given that sex and intimacy is so constitutively ambivalent and ambiguous and not always straightforwardly pleasurable. Despite what the sex positivity discourse might have you believe, it's a more complex kind of picture.
Absolutely.
So I think that has to be taken into account when we talk about the politics of safer space, particularly in that context anyway.
And I mean, one of the first achievements that some of the awareness teams, but also the collectors themselves, like Room for Resistance, for instance, or Buttons, is that I'd say maybe probably like 5 years ago or 4 years ago, the dark rooms are labeled as all gender dark rooms. However, it doesn't make them, just by labeling them as them and just by setting up a set of rules of how to behave in the dark room, doesn't mean that it's a safer space for everybody who doesn't identify as a cis man. This is just the beginning, I would say. And that's the beginning, and it's the easy step, I would say. But then when we talk about what are the spatial politics around it that actually makes everybody within the community feel safe there, then it gets complicated. And that's also where I think that the space itself, the way you design it, is doing probably like 15% of the entire job of making that space welcoming and inclusive to all community members. The rest is much more complicated. And that has to do with different understandings of what intimacy is, what sex is, different sex practices, different notions of, yeah, what you feel comfortable with or what you want to experience in there. And again, very different experiences, positionalities. And the linkage to what does the space then need to offer is what I find very interesting. And what I'm looking forward to doing more research on.
It's a pity that I miss your talk on this Friday at Floating University, but I'm kind of happy that I could listening to you talking to each other about this topic. And I'm sure that you're going to, more deep into the examples and your discussion on this Friday. I have one more question to you and also to you. To you, Jamie, I read about your research and also found that you did or you are doing your field work using social networks, for instance,
yes,
about gay dating world and culture. And as a scholar, I'm also doing that too in Korea.
Yeah.
And to be honest, because I met my husband many years ago, before there was even wireless internet,
yeah,
I never used that. So I'm on these apps for the first time and it's really overwhelming. Plus, I have some, difficulty to find out my position there because I put all my research profile on the gay dating app. Like, I'm a researcher. I'm looking for someone to talk to. No one talked to me. What kind of experience did you make in your research? And to you, Anna, well, this is also a common question to both of you, actually. I'm making this experience that through this research, not only my perspective over my interview partners, for instance, but also about myself is constantly changing or challenged. So for instance, when I'm going to Korea and I believe that, I could just merge into this scene because I look Korean and I'm from here, I can speak the language. And then people begin to tell me that, you're just like a foreigner. Yeah, I'm making such experiences. So how does your work change your concept of yourself?
That is an interesting question. Okay, so first to the Digital Intimacies project. Mm-hmm. So the intention of that project was to look at hookup apps like Grindr and Scruff and whatever else might be kind of used, but to look at the smartphone more generally. Mm-hmm. So we were also interested in the phone, the camera, other sorts of social media platforms. I mean, a lot of work has been done, it's a small field, but in this field, a lot of work has been done on hookup apps. And that's a very particular type of space. And we wanted to capture different sorts of intimacies that you get across, these different sorts of platforms. Unfortunately, the way that the project was organized meant that I didn't do the interviews, which is a source of enormous frustration for me. I would love to have done the interviews. I love doing interviews. I love speaking to people. So in that respect, I can talk slightly at a distance, I suppose, from having conversations with the postdoc on the project and then looking at the transcriptions. And I understand what you mean about kind of being overwhelmed. I mean, the thing for me, I'm an optimist, I suppose, and I feel optimistic about vernacular creativity and ingenuity of queer people. I mean, we've been talking about community spaces, but also in their intimate lives. And one of the most fascinating things that has come out of the project is how radically so-called ordinary people in their everyday lives are conceiving of what intimate practices are. So I'm not just talking about sex, mm-hmm. although there were kind of interesting ways that the smartphone was used to negotiate kind of sex and intimacy, particularly during the pandemic, where people really had to be creative and thoughtful about what they were doing. But also in terms of just redefining intimacy kind of completely. And I've got a fanzine here, which I'll give to both of you, where we kind of are trying to publicize some of our findings to kind of more academic audiences. I can put the link on the website when you put this up. But so just a couple of examples. So there was a person who described they are of Asian heritage. I believe they came to the UK through Austria. And similarly, as you've just said, Simon talked about the racism on the scene and around kind of very Eurocentric beauty norms, and talked about finding this influencer on Instagram, someone called Alec V. Menon, who talks very openly about these issues, about being a person of colour, I think about being non-binary or trans, I forget how they identify. And one of the things they talk about, the kind of body, particularly around body hair. And this was so inspiring to this person. They went to see Alok speak at a public event together, and he described eyebrow threading as a really powerful form of intimacy. They thread each other's eyebrows, and they're involved in kind of hair removal practices. And for him, in this context, that was a form of intimacy. People talked about the intimacy of a night out, So not the intimacy that you might get with your husband, but the intimacy of being in a collective space with your community, who you might recognize, where there might be a degree of anonymity. And I can kind of give kind of more and more examples of what I understand to be completely radical redefinitions of intimacy. And I would never have expected that. You know, I went in thinking I was going to be looking at sex and intimacy and people and open relationships, and which we do, and those things have come up and, you know, they have been important. I mean, that I think has been the most surprising and inspiring thing to me, you know, as we've been discussing, that what people can do in their everyday lives, even in the most impossible kind of constraints, the creativity that they can bring to everyday living continues to be inspiring. I learn from them. I'm an academic, apparently, with expertise. I'm continuously learning from my participants about this. And yeah, so I don't think it maybe is quite getting what you're getting at, but that was, and in terms of how it's transformed me, I mean, I'm so grateful to have a job where I can just read about intimacy. It just makes me think about my own relationship, my own kind of personhood and my own place in the world and, you know, my hang-ups, my insecurities and the things I'm adventurous about, and the constant ability to be reflexive, not only in relation to what I've just said, the people that I speak to, or at least the transcripts that I read, but the theory as well. You know, it's not just about what's happening on the ground. It's the way that we as academics and others have theorized that and how those things are in conversation. And that becomes a kind of reflective practice for me in my personal life, I would say.
Thank you. And Anna?
I can only second that. It had the same effect on me. Very transformative, very eye-opening, very moving, emotionally moving. In the beginning, I think I had a very narrow notion of what is intimacy and queer intimacy. By starting the discussions, the observations, the conversations, and reading more, I kind of use it now as a heuristic device. And I'm impressed and overwhelmed by the multiplicity and plurality of intimate practices and definitions of intimacy and things that I think make up a space intimate or create intimacy. It's overwhelming. And there's a lot of practices that you usually wouldn't relate to intimacy in a narrow definitions. I find that IPRO thing very, very fascinating. And I found a lot of other practices that have a very spatial notion. They all create spaces in a certain way, but also take place in certain spaces only, that I find very interesting. But also, these can be things that are also very much linked to caring practices. But it extends both notions of what I understand in traditional notions as care and intimacy. And realizing that and making sense of that might have a huge transformative effect on me and myself and how I make sense of the world and how I feel in these spaces and with these people.
Yeah, and only to add to that, one of the definitions of intimacy we use in the project is, I'm paraphrasing again, is Lauren Balance. I think they actually say attachments that we depend on for living. And how that can be very easily transposed into the caring context. And that was partly to show what's at stake in practices of intimacy, but also practices of care, I would say, that we depend on them for living. Life is what's at stake when we discuss this. But it was also part of a project, you know, that Lauren Balan and Michael Warner were involved in terms of trying to expand what we understand as intimate and as care, you know. And I think that's the things that, you know, it sounds like we're similarly interested in the material conditions that provide spaces of intimacy and spaces of care and allow people to kind of thrive and survive in their life.
What I find very interesting here is that many of these intimate practices, or the practices that create intimacy, queer intimacies, are not in the spaces where usually these practices would be thought to take place. For instance, doing eyebrows or doing hair would be associated with at a hair salon. But these are practices that are then taken into particularly public spaces, partly because many queers live in very precarious living conditions, like small housing situations, but also because the public space offers a way of ever including more people. And it's a political practice itself of claiming that space and clearing that space through these practices. From clothing swaps to massage classes in a park to performances to language classes to using, I would say, a hetero bar for a night of queer life. I think this is where space comes in as well, and where the spatial context also affects of what kind of intimacies you could create there and what people experience as intimate or not.
And again, just only to add that in terms of space, thinking at a different scale, perhaps, it seems like what you're describing happens more in Berlin because it has yet to be. So as you know, London is the centre of the kind of neoliberal project and that bears out in the city. And queer spaces have disappeared. It's been mapped, you know, very rigorously by people in urban planning, actually. And all the practices that you've just been describing, my sense, and I haven't done a rigorous study of this, but just as a person that lived in London for the last 20 years, doesn't happen nearly as much because every inch of land gets turned into a possibility for kinds of commercial development.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, of course, London is much more advanced when it comes to hypercapitalism.
And it's
it's at the front of neoliberalism. However, a lot of queer spaces in Berlin had to close. Gentrification is massive in the city. These cities are, and these places are always in a very precarious situation, and that is when the public space comes in and becomes even more important, even if only temporary. But I think because of the political culture in the city, it's a common practice to also take over public space or to reuse space that actually has been designed for completely different use for these practices.
Yeah.
But, I mean, a lot of clubs and bars had to close, a lot of even the institutions of the official service provider, from Schulberatung to Lismikas, are always in kind of precarious situations. And the community grows, but at the same time, they can't provide more infrastructure because of the space is money and they can't get new spaces to provide all kinds of services. So this is when the public space comes in, I think. And I think COVID kind of worked as a facilitator of that because everybody used public space in multiple and sometimes different ways than before. But it's a political practice, but it's also a practice out of a need of just having to have a space where you can meet and care for each other or create community.
Connections you depend on.
And in the end, like, any space can be used for that.
Well, that connects well to the beginning of this conversation about Care Manifesto, because one of the four things that you're emphasizing on to create promiscuous care in this world is public space, right?
Yeah. So there's a chapter on caring communities and imagining what a caring community might look like, and draws on kind of traditions in the UK context of things like radical municipalism, where kind of municipal like town halls, for instance, would introduce kind of community building and things like that. It seems to me, from the research I've begun to do and listening to Anna speak, that there's a lot to learn from the queer community in Berlin and how its work, as they radiates out of the city, because it feels to me this is very much a transnational phenomenon. And it isn't just about, it seems to, correct me if I'm wrong, Anna, it's not just about raving, which I would say is important anyway, but it's about community building. And the rave might be a central node within those practices, but it's about taking care of each other, building spaces of intimacy, building community, and having and continuously doing the work to build kinds of caring communities, basically.
Even if it's a nightlife space, I mean, every individual has their own motivation of why they come to a club, I would say. Some come for that, some come for sex, some come for meeting their friends. But a side effect, a sometimes unanticipated gain of using these spaces, is that a lot of knowledge is generated and transferred in these spaces beyond knowledge around of sex and drugs, which is usually assigned to these spaces.
Yeah.
It's about care practices. It's about how different people maneuver their life through this quite harsh city. It's about sharing experiences. It's about finding a job, finding housing. It's like all kinds of really important knowledge, social knowledge actually that are shared as a byproduct of using these spaces. And this is how there are spaces where communities practice, but also where further communities are built actually in the end. But not necessarily intentionally. Sometimes intentionally, as in the case of the manifesto the club might have or the club collective might have, and the politics, the outspoken politics of that space, or because the awareness team also like really fosters the community building there. But most often it's a side effect of just having a space to mingle and observe and silently observe also across generations sometimes even. And this is why they are very important as an urban infrastructure also. As a social infrastructure, as a cultural infrastructure, and sometimes even as a health infrastructure.
Right. I can't wait to read your researches and also follow you up.
I also want to hear about your research.
Yeah.
And how your research is actually linked to
I'm right in the middle of collecting data.
Cool.
And I do some parallels, but also some differences to what you explained today. So I'll definitely get in touch with you and maybe we can have another round of talk.
Yeah.
If not.
Left hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for taking your time and also sharing your knowledge and sharing your experiences and your wisdom. And I hope we can also all contribute to thriving queer communities and spaces all over the world.
Indeed. And thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.